The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. As we're heading into flu season, we thought we'd shine the light of science and reason on a particularly timely subject, vaccines. We'll be taking on the most popular myths and misinformation and discussing what the evidence says about the risks and benefits of vaccination. To help us out, we'll be joined by Dr. David Gorski, managing editor of the brilliant website, Science-Based Medicine. But first, let's meet someone who's doing his part for vaccine awareness. I'm here with Laird Shaka, a New York accountant who is trying to get a new project off the ground. Welcome, Laird.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this interview.
So tell us about the Vaccine Times.
The Vaccine Times is a quarterly newsletter. It follows along the guidelines of my blog, which is Vaccine Central. It's basically a publication by parents for parents, and the goal is to make science-based information about vaccines accessible to parents. I have various sections in it. There's a section about news, a section about vaccine-preventable suffering, a section about vaccine science, and a few others that I'm working on. The idea is to make the Times available as a printed publication in pediatricians' offices, because most parents do not read skeptical blogs, they don't listen to skeptical podcasts, but almost all of them will go to the pediatrician. And while waiting around, they'll pick up whatever magazines the office makes available. So I thought to myself, what an opportunity to get our message to the parents in a way that's not being done, to the best of my knowledge, is not being done. And if only we can succeed to make the Vaccine Times into a printed publication and get pediatricians to subscribe it, which sounds much easier than it is in reality.
Well, this is actually really a solid strategy because with kids being the germ factories that they are, parents are actually spending a lot of time in the waiting rooms of pediatricians.
Absolutely. You know, so instead of reading Parents Magazine or Teen, they might as well be reading something about vaccines, some information they can actually use. So we'll give it a try.
So why exactly are you so interested in vaccine promotion?
For various reasons. The first and foremost, it's because in the end, this sort of anti-scientific stance hurts children who cannot fend for themselves, who have to rely on their parents and their caregivers to make the right decisions for them. And if the parents or the caregivers are being fed wrong information, they will make the wrong decisions, and the children will end up paying the price. Secondly, it's because I feel that the anti-vaccination groups are being very successful at spreading their sort of misinformation to the public, and we just need to do something to counter that. I don't think we in the skeptical movement right now are going about it the right way. The anti-vaccine groups use fear to grab people's attention, and we're just going at them with facts only and dry statistics, which may not be very effective. And this is the reason why one of the features in the Vaccine Times is called Vaccine Preventable Suffering, in which I will present a case about a person, usually it's a child, who was hurt or who died from a vaccine-preventable disease, just to grab people's attentions, and then maybe, hopefully, after seeing that, they will be willing to listen to the facts which we have to present them.
Now, just to clarify, you don't have a medical background, correct?
No, absolutely not. I'm not medically trained. In fact, in my blog, Vaccine Central, I have a disclaimer at the homepage, which makes it clear that I'm not qualified to give medical advice. And I always advise parents that whenever they're making a medical decision, they need to speak to their doctor.
So your goal is to get vaccine information to the people that need it most then, which are the parents of young children.
That's
so
correct.
Do you imagine that you'll have any problems getting the doctors on board?
I hope not. I mean, this is an enterprise that will help them answer the questions that parents have and the parents raise. And I don't see a reason why doctors would be opposed to this idea. I mean, we're going to take care, we're going to take very much care to make sure that any information that goes in the Vaccine Times is sound and it's coming from the best sources available. And we're going to try, I mean, it's possible we can fail, but we're going to try to stay away from presenting our own opinion. The idea is just to present the science facts to the parents.
Now, I find it interesting that You are a lone blogger who has decided to do this. Is it kind of interesting that there isn't a larger organization trying to do this, that you have to do this on your own?
Well, hopefully, you know, hopefully I'll be able to raise some awareness, and maybe one of the big organizations will become interested in sponsoring maybe, or just getting involved in making this a more professional product. To the best of my knowledge, there isn't any of the big organizations that are taking care of this at this level. I mean, there's a lot of information on the web. If you go to the Centers for Disease Control website, there's lots of information there, and there's lots of blogs and everything. But yeah, it's surprising. So hopefully, you know, we'll be able to bridge that gap a little bit.
So how exactly are you asking people to help?
Oh, there's various ways that people can help. I mean, the easiest thing that they can do is to just subscribe to get the free version of the Vaccine Times. So the next issue should be coming up towards the end of the year. As I said, it's a quarterly. And we are also, with the help of my new editors, we're redesigning the first issue to make it look a little more professional. So that's one way they can help, is to send an email to vaccinetimes@gmail.com, and just a blank email with the title subscribe, and then we'll add them to the list. Another thing that they could do is that anyone that has any specific expertise in any of the areas that we'll be involved with publishing a publication like this can help us. For example, I already got two editors that are helping me with this. First, I have a layout and design editor. Her name is Julia Sherrett. She's helping with the redesign of the first issue and the design of the second issue. She has her own website at juliasherrett.com. That's Julia, J-U-L-I-A, Sherrett, S-H-E-R-R-E-D.com. And I encourage everyone to look it up and read her free book about her struggle with lupus. It's quite fascinating. Other ways people can help is to subscribe to the blog on Kindle. I have that. Vaccine Central is available on Kindle, and it's only 99 cents, and any money that's raised that way will go towards supporting the Vaccine Times project. Lastly, any commercially viable blogs or podcasts can think about taking out ad space. Big skeptical organizations can also think about buying some ad space or buying batches of the Times to give out at their next local event. And that's pretty much in a nutshell what people can do to help with the project. They can contact me directly at vaccinetimes@gmail.com. Any comments, any advice, it's all welcome. They can also yell at me if they want and call me a shill, but I hope not.
I tend to have a lot of people that people think are shills on the show. What's it like being a shill?
It's fantastic. You know, I get a free subscription to Shilling Weekly. You know, my checks that I get are fairly nice. And, you know, it's a good lifestyle. You know, we're living the life over here. But, you know, jokes aside, it's kind of sad that people that tack labels onto you just because you disagree with them. And, you know, it comes to the territory. There's nothing that we can do. Best we can do is just to stick to valid, solid information and just present that. And then the reaction will be what it will be.
Thanks for being here, Lert.
Well, thank you very much, Desiree. It's been great being here. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You can find all the details about the Vaccine Times, including how you can help, at vaccinecentral.wordpress.com. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes. And while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Before we get to our interview with Dr. Gorski, I have someone lovely in the booth with me, the scientific paranormal investigator and past guest, Ben Radford. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be on.
So why are you here in Edmonton, Ben?
Well, funny you should ask. I'm doing a talk this evening. It's a talk called Reflections on a Decade of Paranormal Investigation. And it's basically a survey of the last 10 or 12 years of my investigations into all manner of weirdness, from ghosts to miracles to Bigfoot to crop circles and whatnot. So sort of giving people a look into the skeptical and scientific side of those sorts of mysteries.
So what do you mean by the scientific side for people who haven't heard my interview with you?
Well, essentially, you know, approaching them with an open mind, but not as they say, not so open that your brains fall out. You know, trying to approach the topics using scientific methodologies, critical thinking, and logic, as opposed to, I don't know, the way that the ghost hunters do it, which is sort of wandering around scary places with flashlights and thinking that anything they weird is a ghost. So it's you know, analyzing mysteries, again, from a strictly scientific point of view, and not for example, using Ouija boards and pendulums to find ghosts.
Now, you were busy last week with a UFO case.
Yeah, in fact, there was a mysterious bunch of lights over Manhattan. There was the Manhattan UFO wave, and I got a call from ABC News reporter saying, "Hey, tell us what these UFOs are over Manhattan." And I hadn't seen it, so I'm like, "Oh, hold on a second." So I like fired up my computer. I'm like, "Oh yeah, I know what that is." I told them that my best guess was that it was wayward balloons, because they actually looked identical to some UFO experiments investigations I'd done previously, and I explained that the way they were moving based on the videos that I saw, all of it looked exactly like balloons. And I was proven correct later that day, that afternoon. Sure enough, a school teacher at a nearby place in Mount Vernon said, "Yeah, but we had balloons. Apparently, there was a party for I think it was a retirement or some sort of party for a teacher, and they accidentally let loose a bunch of balloons." And sure enough, that's what it was. So I sort of jumped out there. And I said, "Well, this is what I think it is, but you know, I don't know. This is what." And of course, again, I was right. So.
Are those typically the kind of cases that you get?
Probably I would say a third of the cases that I get are brought to me by the media and journalists who have seen my work in Skeptical Inquirer magazine or seen my new book. And they've seen some of my past cases, and so they're like, "Hey, you're the go-to guy. You've solved these mysteries." And so a lot of times those, either that or, for example, I'll come across cases that are local regional cases where there's for an example, the Santa Fe Courthouse ghost was one of my best-known cases. So sometimes they just sort of come to me. Other times I get a weird phone call at, you know, two in the afternoon on a Thursday from someone saying, "Hey, did you see this?"
So are those the kind of things that you're going to be discussing tonight then?
Yeah, I'll be covering a wide variety of topics, sort of how to approach the paranormal, just sort of, you know, what does it mean when we say something is paranormal? What does it mean just, you know, analytically? And you know, approaching these things, again, from a scientific point of view, and drawing a lot of from my own case files. Again, I've done dozens and dozens of cases on just about any topic you can think of. And so I can often sort of reach back in my archives and say, "Oh, well, and this is, you know, here's this case and here's how I solved this case as well." So it hopefully people will bring their questions as well, and we'll have some fun with it.
You're actually speaking three times in Alberta, and you're doing two talks like the one this evening, one here and one in Calgary, but you're also doing a workshop in Calgary.
I am. I'm doing a scientific paranormal investigations workshop tomorrow, starting, I think, at 3:30 p.m. In Calgary. I don't have the time and date in front of me, but they can find it. And it's basically an intensive investigations workshop where I get really into the nuts and bolts of, you know, how exactly is this done, the methodologies, interviewing eyewitnesses, again, more case studies, how to analyze ghost photos, and things like that.
So it's really like a do-it-yourself ghost hunter workshop.
Yeah, ghost hunter, lake monster hunter, miracle investigator, blah blah blah. You know, whatever. If you're looking into something that is, you know, definitely weird and possibly paranormal, my workshop will tell you how to go about finding out whether it is or not.
So for everyone listening, if you'd like to meet a real live scientific paranormal investigator, Ben will be speaking at the Central Academic Building at the University of Alberta right after the show. That's at 7:30. For those of you listening on other stations or by podcast, we apologize for bragging. We wish you could be here too. I should also note that these events were made possible by the Center for Inquiry, CFI Calgary, and the Greater Edmonton Skeptic Society. You can find out more about the Calgary events at cficanada.ca/Calgary or at edmontonskeptics.com. Thanks for popping in, sir.
Well, it's good to be here. It's nice to see the setup here. I've listened to it before, enjoyed the show, and it's very cool.
Thank you. And now on to our feature presentation.
I'm on the line with Dr. David Gorski, surgical oncologist at the Barbara and Karmanos Cancer Institute in Detroit, Michigan. He is also the managing editor of the very popular Science-Based Medicine, a website that explores the issues and controversies in medical science. Dr. Gorski has been blogging relentlessly on vaccines, and I'm very happy to have him on the show. Dr. Gorski, are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for being here.
Yes, I guess I am here then.
So let's start off with the basics. What exactly is a vaccine?
Wow, I haven't had to answer that one in a long time. A vaccine, the idea of vaccination is basically that you take some part of the organism, the virus, the bacteria, whatever, that causes the disease, and you basically find out the part of that protein, or the part of that organism that is, you know, that causes the biggest, you know, the most effective immune reaction, and you use that in order to prime the immune system so that when the actual organism comes, it's already built up, you know, a ready-made immune response.
So how does the concept of herd immunity work with that?
Well, even if people are... vaccines aren't 100% effective. So, you know, they vary. You know, like some vaccines are very effective, greater than 90%. Some, like the flu vaccine, fluctuate from year to year. They're not as effective, in other words. But what that means is that the disease being vaccinated against can still be transmitted, even in a population that has with a fairly large number of people who are vaccinated. There's a certain critical threshold of the percentage of the population that has to be vaccinated in order to stop that, or, you know, that transmission, or to cut it way down. And that's the concept of herd immunity. As a general rule of thumb, around 90%, you know, it varies for depending on the vaccine and the disease, but as a general rule of thumb, it's around 90% of the population needs to be vaccinated to have effective herd immunity. And the thing about herd immunity that's so important is that not every child can be vaccinated. Some have medical contraindications to certain kinds of vaccination. If there is herd immunity, they still get almost all of the protection of being vaccinated, because the organism is rare and not transmitted even among the is not transmitted much in the population. So herd immunity is very important for children who can't be vaccinated for whatever reason. It's also important just because to drop the rate of the disease down even lower, because, as you said, vaccines are not 100% effective.
So that being said, there are many people who are concerned about vaccines. So let's start at the start. What is actually in a vaccine?
There are two general types of vaccines. There are ones that are inactivated, which means that there's no living organism in them. It's just it's either proteins, which can be either isolated from the killed organism, or can be produced through genetic engineering. And then there are adjuvants, which are substances that can increase the immune reaction to the proteins that are in the vaccine. And then there are a bunch of other things like buffers, leftover, the trace chemicals left over from the manufacturing process. There used to be, until the early 2000s, in a lot of vaccines, a preservative called thimerosal, which in and of itself has been a major rallying point for the anti-vaccine movement, at least in the United States. That's not in vaccines anymore, other than at least not the routine childhood vaccines, although it is still in some flu vaccines. The thimerosal contains mercury, so that's the big scary thing there. The other kind of vaccines are attenuated viruses, usually. In other words, they've been weakened so that they actually can't cause disease, but they can cause an immune reaction. For instance, I forget the exact the trade name, but there's the flu vaccine, the intranasal flu vaccine, which you can that's actually a attenuated virus. So those are the two main kinds of vaccines. You know, you may have heard in some of the anti-vaccine literature or seen it that one of the things that they will try to scare people about is, oh my God, there are the toxins in the vaccine.
Right.
These are compounds that are actually usually present. These are compounds that are present in, you know, really small amounts, not any amount that could cause any harm, but they do have scary chemical names, like formaldehyde. Never mind that the body makes more formaldehyde than you could ever get from vaccines, just as a part of the process of normal metabolism. There are other claims that, as far as the scary sounding chemicals in the vaccines.
Well, let's actually talk about thimerosal for a second, because that is one that continually comes up. So, as you said, that is mercury, basically. So how much mercury is in a vaccine?
In most vaccines, it's just a trace amount. However, in the ones that actually have thimerosal added to them, I believe it's 25 micrograms, which is still a relatively small quantity, but it's measurable, and it is, originally, I always said that the concern in the 90s was not entirely unreasonable, although there was no real good evidence that thimerosal was associated with autism and a lot of good evidence that it wasn't. But it's a quantity that was used. The amount that is used is a preservative, you know, for multi-use vials. And the question, the reason it was there was to prevent contamination in multi-use vials, to keep the bacteria from growing if inadvertently a small amount of bacteria got into the solution when the vial was entered more than once. Now, thimerosal is actually ethyl mercury, so and dishonest sorts of things that the anti-vaccine people will do is they will use guidelines for methyl mercury, which is a different substance,
right,
and has a different level of toxicity.
Where does the connection between thimerosal and autism come in then? Where does that concern come from?
This is the classic case of confusing correlation with causation. Basically, there were more and more vaccines added to the schedule in the late 80s and early 90s. And, of course, some of these were very good vaccines, like the Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine. That was a deadly disease up until 20 years ago. And now it's pretty uncommon because we have a vaccine for it. But as more vaccines were added to the schedule, it was noticed that the amount of thimerosal preservative in some of the vaccines were adding up to an amount of mercury that people started to get a little concerned about, which is part of the whole reason that in the late 90s, the CDC and the AAP issued recommendations that thimerosal be removed from most vaccines. But in any case, it's one of those things where, okay, you have more vaccines and more thimerosal, and at the same time, the incidence of autism began to take off. Now, we can argue back and forth whether this is a true increase in incidence or whether it is due to the broadening diagnostic criteria, increased awareness, it's a number of other factors that don't actually result in a true, quote-unquote, true increase in the incidence of autism. But there does appear, you know, from the early 90s till now, you know, a large increase in the reported incidence of autism at around the same time when there was an increase in the amount of mercury in the vaccine schedule. So, classic case of confusing correlation with causation, because, you know, the studies ultimately were done. For instance, the perfect study was done when we took the thimerosal out of vaccines. You know, if there was a major link between thimerosal and vaccines and autism, what would you expect to happen when you took the thimerosal out of vaccines?
Right.
You would expect that the incidence of autism would level off and then start falling again back to where it was before, you know, the thimerosal-containing vaccines were added to the schedule. It didn't. It kept rising. You know, there are multiple other lines of evidence. There's, for instance, there was a recent study just a month or two ago in pediatrics that described how they basically could find no correlation between thimerosal exposure and the risk of autism or autistic spectrum disorders. So, you know, there are several lines of evidence converging on the same conclusion that mercury in vaccines is not associated with autism. Can we say with absolute certainty that there's no linkage? Well, you can never say that in science. However, you can say that with a high degree of certainty, there is no detectable linkage at the sensitivity at which we could detect such a linkage, which is about as close to saying that there's no link as you can say in science.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. If you have a question on vaccines for Dr. David Gorski of Science Based Medicine, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So, some of the concerns that we hear about vaccines, most notably from celebrity Jenny McCarthy, is that it's not necessarily the ingredients that we should be worried about, it's the vaccination schedule itself. So, can you break that argument down?
That's the too many too soon argument, which, quite frankly, from my perspective, emerged as the evidence was increasingly going against their previous favorite idea that it was the mercury stupid, which is what they actually said. You know, Jenny McCarthy's current organization is Generation Rescue, which is an organization founded by a man named J.B. Handley and his wife, who, as you might expect, have an autistic child. And back then, it was all about the mercury. And in fact, they said autism is a misdiagnosis for mercury poisoning. That was their claim. Then around 2008, they switched. As the evidence was coming in, they basically switched to too many too soon, which from my perspective is a much more vague hypothesis, which therefore has the advantage to them of being more difficult to falsify. However, you know, there are, you know, essentially a number of studies that show no correlation between, you know, vaccines and autism. That includes the MMR studies that don't find a correlation between the level of vaccination and the risk of autism. These studies are one of those things where each individual study, you know, you can criticize simply because they're epidemiological studies, and with epidemiological studies, it's always difficult to have, you know, absolute controls and to control for every confounding factor. But if you look at the march of them together, you know, again, it's the converging lines of evidence. I like to liken it to evolution in a way, because it's the sort of thing where you can find individual studies that sound like they refute evolution, but they don't. It's the convergence of evidence. It's from multiple different studies that strongly support the conclusion that there is no association between vaccines and a risk of autism.
And we have a question from the website.
I received the following argument from someone who is anti-vaccine, and I'm just wondering if you could tell me where the reasoning or science is flawed. If you take a normal adult person and give them 9 to 12 vaccines that a baby receives within a 3-month period, but at the same doses with respect to the body size and weight, would there be any risk to the adult person? That's from Chris Lindsay.
I'm not sure I've heard that one before, actually. I honestly can't think of a reason why there would be. For one thing, these days, vaccines have many fewer antigens, and antigens are either proteins or the little parts of the proteins that provoke the immune response than vaccines in the past. So, Dr. Offit has made a statement that he's kind of infamous for, not so much because he's wrong, just because the anti-vaccine movement seized upon it because it sounded frightening to them. Mm-hmm. And he was basically saying, because the human immune system can handle like 10,000 vaccines, and he was just thinking in terms of antigens. He's not actually talking about 10,000 injections, but the point is, if a normal adult receives scaled up what a child receives, there's no real scientific reason that I can think of that this would cause significant harm or any harm at all. However, it's the sort of thing that's not likely to be done, so it's a good, it's probably a good talking point for the anti-vaccine movement because it sounds scary, and the only way you can really refute it is that there's, that based on prior principles, you can't see a reason why this would be harmful.
And we have another question from the website.
It seems some states and provinces are trying to legislate around the medical literature and evidence-based standard of care. For example, a couple of American states are trying to legislate chronic Lyme disease into existence, even though there's no evidence for it. In Canada, there's a growing movement by provinces to ignore the consensus about liberation therapy for MS and want to devote limited research funds to what the medical community seems to think has low plausibility. Could Dr. Gorski comment on these cases, and if the AMA et al. Are troubled about vote-seeking politicians trying to inject themselves into the standard of care? That's from Carl Mamer.
Now, I find this interesting because they actually have already done this with vaccines, have they not?
There are quite a few states in the United States that allow religious or philosophical exemptions. Now, it's hard to argue from a strictly ideological perspective for these, against these, because, basically with the tradition we've had in the U.S. of, valuing individual autonomy and freedom, it's hard to say that these would be that you shouldn't have these. On the other hand, the anti-vaccine movement has seized upon them. And there are people out there who give, who tell parents and promote the idea that, you should sign up for these religious exemptions, philosophical exemptions. And in states where you actually sort of have to get a note from your pastor, they will, to say, yes, you do belong to this religion and we do not believe in vaccination. They're basically willing to, let's lie if they have to get out of vaccination using these laws. Now, I don't know what the laws are like in Canada regarding vaccines, for instance.
Didn't they actually change the vaccine ingredients in the UK in regards to things like the Marisol, even though there was no particular evidence?
I don't know. I don't know. I do know that in 1999, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC both agreed that thimerosal should be removed from vaccines based on a theoretical concern that it might be that, babies might be getting too much mercury within the first, 6 months of life. And that was largely the effort of one man by the name of Dr. Halsey. I'm afraid I forget his first name. He basically bulldoze this through to through the committee responsible for making the recommendations. Now, pretty much two years later, roughly, thimerosal was out of almost all vaccines. By about early 2002, it was gone. Now, this is one of the things. This is something where what seemed like a reasonable idea that to us at the time backfired spectacularly, because how do you answer the argument when the anti-vaccine movement where you try to say that thimerosal doesn't cause autism, and they point to what the government did and said, but they took it out of the vaccines.
Exactly.
And it's even worse than that, because it was truly Orwellian what the government said, because they said there's no evidence that thimerosal is associated with anything bad. But we took it out of the vaccines to make them even safer. That's basically what they said.
Oh. And we're dealing with the repercussions now.
Yes, but these things have, take on a life of their own. I mean, Andrew Wakefield, for instance, will go to the UK. He's in, for the those who aren't familiar with him, although he's reasonably famous, so a lot of people probably have heard of him. He was the one who in 1998 published a 12-patient case series in which he suggested that measles virus from the MMR vaccine, which is the MMR is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, was somehow associated with autism and gut problems in children with autism. And he published that. And the funny thing is, if you actually read the paper, the conclusions are, couched in the typical scientific, caveats and, the relatively weak, statement of what the conclusions were and, the various statements of this does not demonstrate that, measles virus causes autism or something like that. But Wakefield went out and gave press conferences saying that it did, and that's the message that got out. And that's one we're still dealing with now. Vaccination rates in the UK plunged so to the point, well below herd immunity in some areas of London. I've read that it was, maybe around 60%, which is nowhere near where it needs to be. And measles is incredibly contagious, so you need a really good high level of vaccination to have herd immunity against measles. And the result, predictably, measles came roaring back. It was right. A disease that was declared pretty much under control in the mid-90s in the UK. By 2008, with thousands and thousands of cases a year, it was declared endemic again. It's basically it's back, and so the there are very real consequences to this.
Now, actually, one thing I'd like to point out is we hear often that, from especially Jenny McCarthy is one of the people who has espoused this view, that measles aren't that bad. Would you like to correct that assumption?
In the third world, worldwide, it wasn't too long ago that measles was killing hundreds of thousands of children a year. It still kills. I wish I had looked up these figures, but it still kills something like on the order of 200,000 or 300,000 children a year worldwide, mostly in third world countries. Now, the anti-vaccination people will say, but that's because it's the sanitation, etc. And yeah, that's probably true to some extent, but we also don't have, hundreds of thousands or millions of cases of measles. Now, measles can have complications at the rate of, a few per 1,000 that can be quite serious, like encephalitis, various, other complications. Encephalitis is probably the most feared. Children, there is a mortality rate from measles, and this is today and this day and age. we have been fortunate that, as far as I know, no child has died of measles in quite a long time in the United States. But that's because of the it's because we have a high level of vaccination. What I fear is when, you know, if vaccination levels fall, we get more cases. It's sooner or later, you know, children will die. It's just a matter of time if vaccination rates fall. Now, fortunately, the overall vaccination rate, as far as I know, is still quite high. It's in these pockets, you know, of places where people with anti-vaccine proclivities tend to live, which tends to be like California and various places like Boulder, Colorado. But you know, these could be the canary in the coal mine, because that, you know, when as I've said before, when the outbreaks start, that's where they'll start, is where there's low vaccine uptake.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. If you have a question about vaccines, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more of Dr. David Gorski of Science Based Medicine after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, the first show of our host station's annual Fun Drive campaign features a look at the science of race with Guy P. Harrison, author of Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity. Is there any real biological basis to race? And how does it compare with our cultural understanding? And on Speaking Up, we talk to Noah Nez, author of Native Skeptic, a blog that looks at critical thinking from a Native American perspective. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here today with Dr. David Gorski, surgical oncologist and managing editor of Science-Based Medicine, a website that examines the evidence and analysis around medical fads, health concerns, and controversies real and manufactured. So, David, I work at a place that has the mobile flu shot people come in, which is lovely. Mm-hmm. But that also means that I get to hear firsthand everyone's reasons for not wanting to get a flu shot. So I'd like to go over some of the ones that I hear most often, and you can tell me if the argument has any merit. Does that work?
I'll try.
All right. How about, I'm building up my own immunity by letting my body fight off the flu itself?
Well, that the whole point of a vaccination is to build up your immunity so you can do that without actually getting sick. If you want to suffer through the flu, I suppose that you're right, but stay home and don't actually infect other people. I guess the thing to say to that is, well, it's the same thing. It's the same reason we have to reformulate the flu shot every year. It's a different strains of flu come around and predominate every year. So you can build up your immunity all you want to some strain of flu. It'll just be to that strain of flu that you happen to get. It will not be of any particular use in future years unless that strain of flu comes around again.
So is there any advantage at all then to that idea of building up your own immunity?
What, by getting the disease?
Yes. I'm telling you, David, I hear this often.
The only quote-unquote advantage, I guess, if you can call it that, is that the immunity tends to be longer lasting when you actually get the disease. But, I mean, the cost is you get the disease. So I can't really think of really rational advantage. I mean, that advantage to me, especially since the flu, you know, is different every year, you know, it's unlikely that your longer lasting immunity will be of more protection to you later. And of course, you expose yourself to the flu. And let me just say one thing about the flu. A lot of people just think if they get a little cough, a little, maybe a little fever, that's the flu. No. The flu will knock you on your tuchus. It's it's much more, you know, it's a much more significant illness than just a little cold or a cough, but those often get lumped in with the flu. A lot of people who say they have the flu don't have the flu. They just have a cold.
I can't think of a good reason.
I know. I've gone on long enough on that one.
How about another one I hear a lot is, last time I got the flu shot, I came down with the flu.
Well, depends on what you mean. I mean, one of the reactions to the flu shot, of course, can be fever and kind of flu, you know, mild flu-like symptoms. Actually, it's an indication that you're, you know, mounting an immune response. So, but no, you can't get the flu from a flu shot. Although, yes, some people do get, you know, some mild flu-like symptoms afterwards.
How about the idea that I'm healthy, I eat well, I go to the gym? The healthy people don't need to get vaccinated.
The Bill Maher argument, right?
He would be one of the ones I'm thinking of, yes.
Well, there's just one problem with that. If you go back to 1918 in the flu pandemic, the people who died of that pandemic were not as much the all the elderly. A lot of the people who died in that pandemic were in the prime of their life. They're from, you know, the pandemic actually got its introduction into the United States in a, it, where did it get it? In a military barracks. These are like, you know, 20-year-old men, 18 to 22-year-old men, and, you know, presumably in excellent physical shape. So, you know, sometimes, in fact, it's the vigorous immune response that a younger person can mount that is what actually causes the problems. And then what kills people are secondary complications like pneumonia. There was some indication of that happening, you know, with the H1N1, even though fortunately, thank heaven, the pandemic wasn't as bad as, you know, some of the worst case scenarios are, you know, predicted. So depending on the strain of flu, being young can actually be worse. You know, being healthy, you know, and able to mount a really vigorous immune response can actually be a problem. You know, boosting the immune system is not always a good thing.
Now, you mentioned pandemic. We actually have a related website question.
Whenever there's a pandemic scare, a new vaccine has to be rushed into production. Isn't there a higher margin of error and therefore more risk of potential mistakes and reduced time for testing the new vaccine when there's a push to get the new vaccine out quickly?
There might, you know, that's a hard question. You know, this is one of those things where you're kind of, this is the real world, in other words. So you have a prediction of a pandemic. Well, what do you do? You know, you got to get the vaccine made. Now, the one thing you need to understand about flu vaccines, though, is they're made basically the same way every year. The only thing that changes are the protein, you know, the antigens, you know, which strains are they going to put in it. So, it is a concern, but it's also for, you know, something that the public health officials are looking for. In fact, our public health officials, I know because I blogged about it, had an unprecedented surveillance program looking for potential complications from the H1N1 vaccine. And I haven't really looked up the most recent findings, but as I can recall, they haven't really found anything that untoward or out of the ordinary compared to previous flu vaccines. So, I mean, yes, it is not an entirely unreasonable concern, but on the other hand, think of it this way. If you really do have a pandemic, it's still going to be taking a much bigger risk not to be vaccinated than it is to be vaccinated.
And we have a caller. Go ahead, Phil from Edmonton.
Hello. Well, I have a daughter, she's 3 months old, and we're wondering if we should or shouldn't get the vaccines, and we decided against getting the vaccines just because we don't know what's in them and where they come from and the people that make them.
What specifically led, how do we put this, what was the reasoning for not vaccinating. It's just that?
Well, yeah, it's hard to explain. I don't really understand. Like, I'll give you an example. You go to a hospital, and if you got bulimia, they give you lots of drugs. Like, my sister became a drug addict. And so it seems something wrong with the medical world today where it's all just give drugs instead of... Like, for bulimia, it's like a spiritual problem rather than a physical problem. So why give drugs? It's off topic, but the government that's giving these vaccines or whatever is the same government that, like, because I believe 9/11 was a demolition project, and so I don't want to take their advice.
There's a lot of different issues here. Let's go with the one. How about what information would you give to young parents to encourage them to actually vaccinate their children?
This is one of those situations where, as I talked about earlier this week when I gave a talk in Montreal, although about a different topic, it's really hard to reach people because people tend to listen to their friends, to people like them, and data, etc. You know, data, scientific studies are all so much noise, or they're not, you know, they're generally not real convincing. I would still try to use it. In other words, I'd point out that there's, you know, the studies are quite clear that that vaccines do not cause autism, do not cause all the other, you know, horrible things that the anti-vaccine movement paints them as causing. I would point out that, you know, they have indeed been extensively tested, and there are extensive post-marketing surveillance programs that they are effective. I mean, for instance, I use the example of Haemophilus influenza type B. Back when I was in medical school, that was about the time, that was right before the vaccine was introduced. That was one of the most feared things in pediatrics, was a severe case of HIB, you know, for meningitis. It, you know, killed children. It was a horrible thing to see. You know, within a few years after the vaccines introduced, you know, the incidence of that plummeted. Vaccination is prevention. That's another thing. Everyone talks about, you know, preventative medicine and maintaining health. It is prevention, and it is co-opting the natural, you know, the body's natural immunity. So I never quite understand why people try to make the argument that somehow vaccines are unnatural. They're not, you know, I don't think they're certainly no more unnatural than putting all sorts of various things into supplements and downing them as though they're going to keep you healthy. And we actually have evidence that they work. So it's I guess the question is how to connect, and this is really tough, how to connect on a level that will overcome this sort of mistrust that the caller expressed. I mean, clearly there's more, as you pointed out, there's more mistrust there than just mistrust of vaccines. The whole medical profession, the government, pharmaceutical companies, and sometimes you can't reach them. As depressing as that is.
So do you have any advice for people who are trying to talk to other people about vaccination and about these issues?
Well, I tend, as you probably know, I tend to be kind of blunt about it. Whether that's the best tactic or not, I don't know. I think you just have to be straightforward and lay out and know the facts, and you also have to know the common anti-vaccine talking points, because otherwise you will not be able to counter them or refute them. I must admit that one I hadn't really heard before, but I could sort of argue around it on plausibility. For instance, if you don't know, you know, when they say there's antifreeze in vaccines, that sounds horrible, except if you know that there really isn't and that they're referring to polyethylene glycol, and which just kind of sounds like, which is used in a lot of things and is, as far as we can tell, not a problem. It's a difficult problem to try to convince the people that vaccines are safe. And what I concern myself with, the anti-vaccine movement like Generation Rescue, et cetera, you're not going to convince them. They're dug in. What you need to do, you need to concentrate on the fence sitters, the undecided, or the ones who have been scared by the anti-vaccine movement. And you need to try to give them something to reassure them. As far as I'm concerned, the anti-vaccine movement, it's, like the leaders are the ones that I reserve most of my, nastiness, vitriol, I don't know what you want to call it, but they are not convertible. They're probably not convertible, and the only thing that they serve a purpose for when you're trying to convince the undecided is to try to show how their arguments are false, how they're pseudoscientific, how they don't hold water.
We are actually over time, but I really do want to say one thing. This isn't really a question.
Dr. Gorski, your respectful insolence and SBM posts are always inspiring, and for someone like me who has essentially never formally learned anything about medical science, your writing has been a great asset to my education. I guess I don't really have a question here. I just wanted to throw my admiration onto the airwaves. Thank you. That's from Lee in Winnipeg.
Ah, why, thank you.
Thanks very much for being here, David.
Thank you for having me.
And you can visit Dr. David Gorski at sciencebasedmedicine.org or at scienceblogs.com. You can also visit us at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes and subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. Hello, everyone. I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you one more time about our upcoming Fun Drive programming. Next week, we'll be bringing you the first of two Fun Drive episodes, where we will ask earnestly but enthusiastically for your donations to our lovely host station, the station that generously allows us to monopolize their airwaves and equipment once a week to bring science and critical thought to the masses. Last episode, I mentioned, in addition to the fabulous prizes that we'll be giving away on air, that you could look forward to a multimedia extravaganza. And by extravaganza, I mean that for one episode only, you can tune in to see the Skeptically Speaking team live, on camera, in all our glory. And by glory, I mean stuck in a tiny sound booth, airing clips from past episodes and laughing at our own jokes, and asking you for money. That episode will air live on November 5th. So whether you regularly listen to the program on one of the 21 wonderful stations that rebroadcast us, or you download the show on iTunes, if you're going to listen to one live episode of Skeptically Speaking, make it this one. For more information about Fun Drive and about how to listen live, visit the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And as always, thanks for your continued support of Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is recorded live at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Michael Harrison manages our electronic communications. The soundboard is run by Ryan Bromsgrove. Lisa Skovanek is our assistant studio technician. Post-production editing and additional research by K.O. Myers. Our theme song is written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.